Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is the eighth of 11 conversations with former Secretary of State George P. Shultz. During this conversation, Shultz speaks with former Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Chester Crocker, about the importance of individuals in influencing history. The two further discuss to what degree an individual contributes to history within a framework of abstract forces, such as technological development and economics. We hope you enjoy this week's episode, and be sure to stop by each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
It's a real treat to be with George Shultz, one of the great public servants in American public life since World War II. And there's so many topics we could talk about. I want to start with a big general topic, which is the role of individuals in history. There's debates that exist on the relative weight of abstract forces like economics and technology, the information technology boom, for example, and how that relates to the role of individuals in shaping events, shaping history. I wonder how you see that equation. Do you see individuals in the driver's seat, or are the abstract forces in the driver's seat, or both?
The individuals who know how to really make a difference understand these forces, and they're part of the framework that they use and affect the timing and so on that a leader uses. But I think within that framework, individuals make a giant difference. And I think of people that I've known around the world in government, and I think of people I've known in business and in universities. It just makes a huge difference. Here at Stanford, when Gerhard Casper took over, came from the University of Chicago, he transformed the place, and he was very clear about the mission. He said, it's all about learning. That's it. That's our mission. Everybody's supposed to learn. And then when you get up to the business side, you see how big a difference a good leader makes. And in government, I had the privilege of serving two presidents very directly, and also doing things for, in a minor way, I was in the Eisenhower administration as a staff person. And then I did a few things for President Kennedy and President Johnson. So I got to see those people in operation and see how important it is for a leader to emerge and the difference it makes.
Looking at your years as Secretary of State, which of course is where you and I worked together and where I saw you up close and in action, what kinds of individuals will left the most indelible marks for you in terms of in other countries, in terms of their impact and impact in our relationship and your ability to work with them?
Well, of course, I'd have to start at home with Ronald Reagan, and he gave us wonderful leadership. And one of the reasons was he had thought about the issues carefully. And we're learning more and more about that as we find these essays that he's written out in his own handwriting that that not only gave an opinion, but why he thought what he did. So it was ran very deep. So he was terrific. Margaret Thatcher was similar. She was what I call an agenda politician. She was there because there were things she wanted to get accomplished and she knew what they were. I thought Nakasone in Japan, so different from some of the other leaders of Japan that I knew. Very dynamic, takes positions, and gave leadership there. Gorbachev, of course, made a huge difference in the Soviet Union. And to take a small country, Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore, was a dramatic leader. And you wonder what Singapore would have been if Lee Kuan Yew hadn't come along.
Well, those are all very good examples, and it clearly speaks to a certain approach to engaging with other countries. I want to ask you a question, George, about the way you ran the State Department. There are many people who've had that experience and a whole lot more people who've commented on it and who debate the right way to run the building. It's a complicated foreign service. We have all these posts abroad, and the interagency process and the process with Congress all make it pretty complicated. But what would you say are the three magic bullets to make the State Department work? What are the keys to making it work effectively?
I had an advantage when I became Secretary of State over a lot of the other people who took it. I had been the secretary in three other departments, So I understood a little bit about how government agencies worked. And I'd had quite a little contact with the Foreign Service, particularly when I was Secretary of the Treasury, because I traveled a lot and there was always a Foreign Service officer assigned. And I looked at their cables and I said, yeah, guys understand what's going on. And so I knew how the permanent people in the departments worked, and that was an advantage. And then I'd been associated with a really well-managed company, and I thought a lot about why is this so successful? What do they do? And of course, one of the things they do, it would spend a huge amount of time on people in trying to see that people were in the right kinds of jobs that they could do, and giving them assignments that stretched them, giving them experiences that would lead them on to the next point. And people would know that you're thinking about them. You're not just throwing them somewhere and you want to get a job done. You also have their career in mind and their development in mind. So when I came to the State Department, I had all of those advantages. Mm-hmm. And I had seen, staff work is important, but I had seen that you work through what I've always thought as the line management. Who is the line management in the State Department? It's the main drag is the assistant secretaries for the regional parts of the world. That's your line group. And so it seemed to me I would not organize it the way I had seen many other people do. That is, you surround yourself with some bright young people who you basically rely on and who interact on your behalf with the other people in the department. I thought, no, I don't want to do that. I got one rather senior Foreign Service officer to be an executive assistant. I was there. But then I didn't have any other staff, and I basically said to you as an assistant secretary and the others, you're my staff, and I'm going to interact directly with you. And if I want a memorandum about something to do with Africa, I'm counting on you to produce it, not some young fellow in my outer office who's going to do it and might or might not reflect your thinking. But I would work directly with people, and I think that helps a lot. Helps me understand what you're trying to do, and helps you understand where my thinking is and the president's thinking is. So I think that that's the way I tried to do it, and at the same time, let the Foreign Service know people who are trying to have a system that has their interests at heart and says, you know, here's a person who's very, very good, but that person needs a little of this experience. So let's have an assignment that's going to expand that person's horizons. And when people understand that you are thinking of them that way, I think they're very responsive.
So you didn't create layers between your key lieutenants and yourself, and they had access to you.
Absolutely. And you want direct access. You don't want to hear it secondhand.
Well, that's an important principle. Another one that comes to my mind.
Also, when you have that direct contact, you have to listen. You can't bring them in, and all you do is talk to them. You have to listen to them.
Another example that comes to mind is I remember a certain controversy and debate that swirled around some leaks that had taken place in the middle of the 1980s over one issue or another. And the question that arose was whether or not every building in the executive branch involved in foreign affairs was going to take lie detector tests. You remember that event?
I'm
sure you do. What went through your mind when you decided to take the stance that you took on lie detector tests?
Well, there are certain technical issues that as I studied it, and it's certainly far from infallible. It often detects people as liars who aren't lying, and it fails to detect somebody who can practice and learn how to lie without any qualms. So there's that. But I felt there was something more fundamental. It was saying that we're going to manage this group by fear. Everybody's going to take lie detector tests all the time, and we're out just, and we're, what that message is we don't trust you, and we're going to put the fear of God into you to do right. And I feel that's altogether the wrong way to go about working with people. You start by saying, I trust you. That's why you're here. If I didn't trust you and think you were able to do this job, I'd be finding somebody else to do the job. So that's where I start. And then if somebody misuses that trust, out of here. And that's the way it seems to me you proceed. And if there were a case of some kind, and there was a valid reason to believe that individual X was involved, then I think probably the lie detector might be an appropriate tool, but not necessarily something to bet the farm on. And I felt that the CIA deceived itself sometimes. They got a lot of intelligence, I remember, from some Cubans that turned out to be double agents and had trained themselves to take lie detector tests. And the CIA gave them these lie detector tests and they passed. And they said that must be nonsense.
Do you think we're learning about the need for open systems and looking at all sources of information and intelligence these days? I mean, there is a culture, there used to be anyway, in the intelligence community that it wasn't any good unless you had paid for it or you had broken the law to get the information.
Exactly.
or had bribed someone to get it. Therefore, you know,
yeah, what you
open
get
sources is,
that you're not supposed to get must be more important than other things. And usually it's what you can find in the open sources that is the key. And I was glad to see recently the CIA announced that it's creating a bureau or a unit of some kind that's job is to look at all open sources of information and see what you can make of that. And also, I see we're going to try to expand the number of consulates that we have around. So you have, I'll call them diplomatic boots on the ground, people who understand the language and who have a better chance of being able to interpret right what some piece of information really means and the culture from which it comes, rather than somebody sitting in Washington who's putting together information. That's important to do, but if you're putting information together, you gotta have some idea what the individual pieces you're putting together actually mean.
You need to know how to connect the dots.
Connect the dots, absolutely.
And that leads to a related question. You and I were at a conference recently, and one very experienced veteran at the conference made the observation that these days in our public life, there are very few people who've actually read real books. Very few people who've read history books, for example, about the history and the culture of countries that they're dealing with. And they may not know the language, they may not know where the country came from or the previous experiences we've had in trying to deal with that country. Why is that? Do you think that Americans or American elites are shy of history or tend to be wary of getting involved in history? They think of history as a prison rather than a key. What is our problem with history?
I think an appreciation of history is making a comeback. And I'm fascinated with the popularity of these books about our earlier times. 1776 is very popular. I read it. It's a terrific book. I really learned a lot. And then I read recently a wonderful biography of Alexander Hamilton, and it opened my eyes about the first Secretary of the Treasury and how he awakened to the importance of finance when he was aide to George Washington trying to find some money to pay the troops. There was no treasury to go to, and he decided there better be one.
Well, that's fine on the American side, and it is great. We have to start at home and understand where we came from and how we got to be who we are. And we are kind of a unique country with so many influences in our own history. But we also have to understand a little bit about the people out there.
Absolutely.
And where they came from.
And there's been a diminution in area studies in this country and a diminution in interest in learning languages. Of course, English is spoken so widely that it makes you lazy. And I know in my own career, I had to get my PhD degree, I had to pass French and German, which I did. But I never made use of the languages, so it was a waste of time, really, other than if you know a little of a language, I think it helps you in understanding those cultures a little bit. But area studies we should be doing more of, and right now, with all our problems with the Islamic world, it's just appalling how little we know about it.
I wonder how long, if you take the big picture and try to connect the dots in terms of our relations with the Islamic world, how long will it take us to figure out the key elements of a successful strategy. There is such a temptation to scapegoat an entire culture, which is not at all what we're trying to do, but there is a popular temptation to talk about those people as if they were somehow adversarial to us and this was really a clash of civilizations. How long is it going to take us, do you think, and how many experiences will we need to have to really engage successfully with that part of the world, and for that matter, them with us, because they also have a few things to take care of on their side.
They do.
Yeah.
Well, we should try to learn how to communicate with them a lot better. And if you do that seriously, you know that you've got to do it over an extended period of time, and that you have to start by doing just what you suggested. You have to start by learning about them. If you're going to communicate with somebody, you got to learn something about them and how you get a message across. It's not the same in different cultures. And you also learn that a word like Arab or Islam contains huge amounts of variety, and you better understand what that variety is and have a message that goes, for example, to women. Mm-hmm. That's distinct from women's messages. And you know that there are a lot of unemployed young people hanging around the coffee houses. And it's another audience. And so you've got to communicate with them. And so there's a great variety, a richness of variety that you have to understand. And we're just starting on that.
We are starting on it. We're also a huge country protected by oceans on two sides, which historically made a difference to us, made us feel safe and secure. But these days, there's a smaller world and we're not feeling quite so safe and secure. But the interesting thing is that it tends to be small countries like, for example, Denmark or the Netherlands or Switzerland, which are the most multilingual countries. And we are this great big country with the advantages, you said, of having English as our native language. So is there anything that our national leaders can do to internationalize our body politic a bit more so we make maybe fewer mistakes and get it right the first time?
Well, I think we should be encouraging Islamic studies in this country, for example, and give some support to it. I see that there have been some big donations to Harvard and I think Columbia by a Saudi to do this.
Georgetown, actually.
Georgetown.
Yeah.
Well, I think that I scratch my head about that. I'd rather see American money. Mm-hmm. Doing that. Not that those two institutions aren't very, have great integrity, but still there is an influence.
Yeah.
And so that's good, but it could be better. And of course, we also need to keep track of what's going on in Japan and China and in Europe and so forth. I have paid a lot of attention to demography in the last 8 or 10 years. Caught my eye for some reason. And if you look at comparative demography, it's stunning the variation that you see in the world. And that's got to tell you something about where the future is going to be.
Speaking of the future, there was a book written 15 years ago that got a lot of attention at the time called The End of History. And while it's been stereotyped a little bit, one of the key messages is that open market democratic societies are really the only true answer, and that everybody sooner or later will get to that kind of a system. Do you see inevitability when you think about democracy for all cultures and all countries eventually? Is this something that's inexorable? And what is the sequence of getting there, getting to democracy?
I don't know that it's inexorable, but I think it's a very attractive life for people, and that's what tends to get it to spread as people see, as they can see on their TV screens these days, what life is like elsewhere versus here. And of course, there's some unattractive things as well as attractive things. But there's much more opportunity in the open societies than in the closed societies. And I think people probably, on the whole, want that. So we've seen a lot of change. You remember the Westminster speech that Ronald Reagan gave in 1982? This was one of his big themes, the importance of freedom. He said the communist system would be assigned to the ash heap of history and freedom and so on, and people patted him on the head and said, young man, you'll learn better. The status quo is where it is. Mm-hmm. and the Soviet Union is there. He didn't agree with the detente, the assumption in detente that we're here, they're there, that's life. The name of the game is to get along, peaceful coexistence. But that's not right. We're here, but they're not very stable. They're not necessarily going to be around forever. And that's our basic assumption. So it was interesting how, if you compare 1980 and 1990 in the classifications that Freedom House does, rather carefully, I think it's impressive, of the free and partly free countries, that category increased by about 50% during Reagan's time. And then after he left, some of the rollout from it, the Eastern European countries have been added. So well over 60% of the world's population now lives in more open systems. That wasn't true a while ago. So there's a certain movement in that direction. It's healthy.
It certainly is. There was also a big movement while you were at the State Department in the Reagan years in Latin America.
Yes.
By the end of your time in office, most, apart from Cuba and one or two transitions, most of these countries were democratic. There is today a kind of countertrend.
They were doing well economically, too.
Yeah.
They had a lost decade for explainable reasons, but they were coming alive. And so it was a pretty good scene.
Should we be concerned about a potential countertrend that's a mixture of populist politics by this character in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, demagoguing on how he's going to spend all of his oil revenues and trying to scapegoat Uncle Sam for everything?
Be very concerned. And this goes back to my feeling that you really have to pay a lot of attention to your neighborhood. And we should be doing a lot of gardening, a lot of effort to go there and have good people go there and listen and talk to people and let them know that we're interested and we care and we're trying to understand them and work with them. And with Canada and Mexico, of course, as well. Mexico has an election coming up that doesn't look too promising in terms of who's well in the lead, but anyway, the democratic process put somebody there, so deal with that somebody, whoever it is.
We're doing exactly that in Bolivia right now with a newly elected populist who ran for office on an anti-Yankee banner, and we're trying to engage with him, so I guess the jury's out on whether that will work, but we're trying to engage, as you say. How would you apply this in the case of Brother Putin in Moscow, who we have a relationship with, we have a lot of common interests, important things to work with, but there's a lot of backsliding there, and some would argue that Russia is a case of hijacked democracy or some other form of democracy going in the wrong direction. Should we be elevating democratic principles in our bilateral relations with Russia, and your view, or should we focus more on their external behavior and what they're doing in the near abroad or on terrorism or on Middle East or other issues? How would you evaluate those relative priorities and trade-offs that we have?
Well, I think we should be heavily engaged with Russia. It's one of the most important countries in the world. It's a huge geographic space, huge stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction there. And of course, they have huge gas and oil reserves. So all these things, and they're very creative people. They have a history of in creativity. I think there's an interesting interaction between creative arts and creative science. And I can't prove that, but I think creativity gets in the air sometimes through the arts, and the scientists breathe it, and it helps them. So Russia is a very important country. It's true, it's backsliding as far as openness is concerned, rather clearly, no question, and we need to say that. But at the same time, we need to be working at all these other issues. I'm a believer, particularly of these big issues, that you say to them, you put any issue on the table that you want, and I'll put any issue on the table that we want. And then let's make an agenda out of that. And then let's take that agenda on and schedule meetings fairly frequently so that we work through it. And when you have an agenda like that, then you can get staff work done. And you can have meetings that take place. It doesn't always have to be the foreign minister trying to work that agenda. And so you have a framework, you know what you're doing and where you're trying to go. And I think it also is a way of understanding him better. Russia, even as it goes back, is far different from the way it used to be. It's a much more open society than it used to be, but it is certainly slipping back now.
What you're describing is a doctrine of engagement. We call it constructive, or call it conditional, or call it selective, or
constructive engagement. Where have I heard that?
I don't. Well, it came out of a lot of different regions: Southern Africa, China, lots of places. But it sounds to me like what you're describing is a form of engagement on our terms, but also on theirs a little
bit. Absolutely.
Where would you draw the line? Who would you not advocate that we could engage with? I mean, is it not a doctrine that would ever work with the Iranians today or with the North Koreans, or could it work there as well? I mean, is there a red line that some regimes are just not engageable?
Some are hard to engage, but I don't think we should be afraid to talk to people. It's a question of what you talk about. And if you won't talk to somebody, you're just throwing in the towel. And of course, there are some places where it's not safe to have an embassy. We see what happened to our embassy in Tehran way back when. So you have to be conscious of that. But I should think, I don't see any reason for us not to talk directly to the North Koreans, but not in any way to undercut the six-party talks, which seemed to me to be the right way, but still, you can have talks, and I would talk to Iran for that matter.
Well, it sounds like a universal approach, but it's got to be tailored to each individual situation.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there are ways to talk. For example, with Iran, there was a claims court set up to adjudicate claims we had against them and them against us. Mm-hmm. Was set up in 1980, I guess, as the Iranian hostage crisis was unwound. And when Abe Sofer became the legal advisor to the secretary, one of the things that I asked him to do, and he did it well, was to go and work in the Iranian Claims Court, it was called, at trying to resolve these issues. So he was a major person, distinguished lawyer, and so Iran put somebody of quality there. So they worked on their cases, but they also developed a relationship and a way of having some messages around. It was a form of engagement over something that was useful to both sides, and it put some people together that could communicate. So it's a good thing to do.
Sounds to me like what you're saying is that talking to someone doesn't mean you're saying you like them.
No, it certainly doesn't. But one of the good things about the UN, it's always important to remember, there are some good things about the UN, there's some terrible things about it. But people say it's a talk shop. Well, okay, there's nothing wrong with having a talk shop, a place where everybody goes, and since they're there, and you're there, you talk to them. Fine. Sometimes it's very hard to arrange a meeting between two parties, but if they both go to the same meeting, then it's a little easier to do that talking.
Gives you a good excuse to have a lot of sidebar conversations, too, from time to time.
Sidebar conversations. Right. I know when the UN General Assembly opens, the Secretary of State goes to New York, and you live there for 2 weeks, and it's just a continual one country after another that you see. And it's, you kind of get a feeling of the connectedness of the globe when you do it that way.
I remember it well, and so do you. Endless meetings. The UN, you touched upon an interesting subject. We recently saw an effort in the past couple of years to see if there could be a way to reform and adapt the UN Security Council. And there were a lot of different proposals out there for enlarging its membership to include some of the most important economies in the world that are not in the Security Council as permanent members, such as Germany and Japan, or to include a greater geographic spread of representation among the permanent members, such as including Brazil or India or others. Did that impress you as the right way to go, or were we wise to wind up with exactly the same Security Council that we've had since 1945 with five permanent members? How do you see that equation?
There isn't any good solution because, as you say, the claims of other of countries that aren't permanent members are, in a way, stronger than some who are. After all, India is by far the largest democracy. Mm-hmm. Japan is the second largest economy in the world. So there's no good argument that would keep them out, other than if it's workable at all to have a veto power and have some possibility of coherence. The more countries you get there, the less chance there is that you're going to do that. And if you make a change, it's hard to know where you draw the line. If this country, then why not that country, and so on, and you wind up with a huge group.
Makes it very hard to make tough decisions if you have a larger group.
Well, it's very hard to make decisions that people accept when you have a very small group. So it's one of those things that's not very good. On the other hand, there are a lot of other aspects of the UN that could stand improvement, and it's possible to do it. Their whole administrative apparatus fundamentally puts huge amount of emphasis on representation. And the result of that is that you lose competence. And in the end, if you're going to run something important, you want to have competent people doing it. And here we have this oil for food program that's absolute scandal. And you just know if it were being managed well, that would not have happened. And so you look at that side of it. Then you have these anomalies like the so-called Commission on Human Rights that they reformed but didn't really reform. And our ambassador takes a lot of heat there for saying that. But I think it's important that we have an ambassador that says what's true and doesn't try to paper it over.
There are a lot of issues to be worked in New York, there's no question. I want to turn the discussion for a moment to a subject that I know is very dear to your heart and one that our country grapples with unevenly over the decades, and that's energy. We are seeing energy now at these extraordinary prices really affect the relations among lots of countries in new ways. We're seeing huge amounts of revenues flowing into poor countries for the first time, giving them theoretically a chance for a better future, but some would say that's really the curse of oil. Do you think that that energy politics is going to evolve in some directions that will liberate us as Americans from dependence on high-cost imported oil? Do you think that there's a chance we'll actually wean ourselves a little bit from this dependence?
Well, there's a chance now, because there are many more things that are available today, or that you can almost see are clearly in the wings, that will make a substantial difference. And so we need to use them. We know, for example, that in Brazil, a high proportion of the cars now are propelled by a combination of ethanol and gasoline, with lots of ethanol that comes out of what you grow. So we should want to use more ethanol. So what sense does it make to put a tariff, making it harder, more expensive for us to import ethanol from Brazil and from other countries that would produce it if it weren't, in effect, sort of almost prohibited by a tariff? So you don't need to have a technical breakthrough. You have to have a political breakthrough to do something sensible there.
Is that a partisan issue in American politics, or is it a bipartisan problem? We're just not getting the message.
It's a bipartisan problem, and it comes from people who grow corn and sugar beets and so forth. It's basically a sugar issue. And much of it is in Iowa, which is the first presidential primary. So while the candidates go there, and they know that they've got to be in favor of that program if they're going to have a chance, so they all are in favor of the program, there's only one person who took a different view, and that was John McCain. And he said, the program is a disgrace, and I can't support it, so therefore I'm not even going to bother going to Iowa. So he didn't. He doesn't go. So I give him a lot of credit. That was the Straight Talk Express at its best. So that it's a political problem. And but somehow or other, there comes a time when we need to face up to it. And it may be that sugar prices have gone up around the world and ethanol prices have gone up around enough. So maybe we could get rid of the tariff and still there would be enough of a price here to make it justifiable for people here to produce the stuff.
Let's look at it for a moment.
And there are other things. I don't want to focus on just ethanol, but there are other things that can save you a lot of fuel. So let's use them.
Let's look at it for a moment from the perspective of the producing countries out there that we import from. As you look around the world at the major energy exporters, how many of them have managed their revenues effectively? How many of them have actually made good use of this apparent windfall from Mother Nature that they have? You think of Russia, you think of Saudi Arabia, you think of Nigeria, think of Indonesia.
Well, try Norway. Norway did something interesting. They put a high proportion of the money into a trust fund. Mm-hmm. And the trust fund is basically all the Norwegian people own that trust fund and distributions are made. Alaska did the same thing. So it's possible to do that. It would be a breakthrough if in Iraq something like that were done. It has been proposed. And it's one way of breaking this Sunni-Shia struggle, because if you did that, you'd say the money is being distributed to all the people of Iraq on some basis, like everybody registered to vote or something like that. And then the government would have to struggle for its revenue, would have to tax people, it would have to show in a financial market that it had something to offer. So there are ways of handling it.
Do you have to put the money offshore and escrow it somehow, or hand the funds to Morgan Stanley or someone to do that? I mean, how would you do this?
You just set up a trust fund. Any country can do it. You don't have to pay through the nose to investment bankers to do it.
But that assumes people will trust local institutions, of course.
Yeah, it does. If you have a country where you can't trust anybody, you're in deep trouble.
You know, you're touching on a sensitive point there. There's a lot of countries where you can't trust anybody, I guess.
Well, you've got to be able to trust some.
Yeah. I have one more question I wanted to throw at you to kind of wind up this fascinating discussion, and that's more on the American political side. There's a high degree of partisanship in our public life. It's in all the papers how extreme it is, and particularly in the Congress, but just in general in terms of the tone of our public life. What's it going to take to restore the sense of civility and the sense of occasionally a nonpartisan or a bipartisan approach to problems?
It's a hard problem, and I wish I could give an easy answer. I have a colleague here at the Hoover Institution named Mo Fiorina. He's written a very interesting book. It's called Culture Wars? The Myth of a Divided America. And he's gone around and had a massive amount of data he's assembled. And he asked Republicans and Democrats the same questions about all these hot-button issues, gun control, abortion, and so on, gay rights. And he finds that they're not that much difference as between these two groups. So basically that's saying to a politician, if you can do it right, maybe there is a center. And the way our congressional lines are drawn now, almost all over the country, and it affects the state legislatures as well as the House of Representatives, they're all gerrymandered so that the incumbents can't lose. There are very few changes in an election. In California, which is the biggest state by far, with all of the state assembly representatives, Senate representatives, and all the members of our U.S. Congress, not one seat changed hands in the last election. You've got to know that's a rigged system. So we should change those arrangements. Because what that does is puts all the people are extremists. Both parties are dominated by the extremists when it comes to the primaries. And so that's who you get. And then they graduate to the Senate and start infecting the Senate. And so that's one thing that could be done. But then we can all conduct ourselves in a little more civil way.
We can set good examples.
Set good examples and examples of knowing how to carry on a conversation where you might disagree about something, but you don't have to be disagreeable, as they say.
That's
I thought a good example that people point to often is Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill. And they had lots of differences of opinion, but they had a good time together.
Well, setting a good example is certainly the key to a lot of things, and there may not be anybody today that can stand up and tell the American people with a straight face, we have a problem, we have a rigged system, and we've got to fix it. But if there is a candidate for that job, it might be you, George Shultz. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Chad.